Good morning.
Good morning.
Yesterday, we bore witness to God in action. And it was made very clear to us that our function in life is to be that of a witness, a beholder, disregarding appearances and always seeing God in action. In other words, no matter what the form, outline, or condition may appear to be, we, through this inner vision, bear witness to the omnipresence of the Christ, that is, of the activity of God in human consciousness. Now, this has not been a secret from the world at any time. This has been known throughout the history of the world, and for the most part, you would find agreement on that, even in church religions. You will hear such things as God is all, and God is love, and God is everywhere present, and God is all power. You hear that in their hymns, in their services, in their prayers. And you say, well, then there's nothing new to that. No, there isn't anything new. There isn't anything radically different, except this, that in no religious teaching that I've ever come across except the ancient manuscripts of the original four, nowhere is that accepted or believed. Because there isn't a teaching on earth that accepts God as the only power or the only presence. Otherwise, there wouldn't be two powers. There wouldn't be protective work against one power. There wouldn't be terms like good and evil, God and devil, immortal and mortal, if there were a conviction or even an acceptance of just one. And so you find that whereas the language of Sunday says God is all, the language of Monday is let the buyer beware. Or be careful, or protect yourself, or watch out for the other fellow. Now, the reason that you come upon such contradictions in the religious life of the world is this. The world, as such, has not discovered the nature of error. And therefore, believes that if you are sinning, you are the one who has to be reformed or healed. If you are subject to false appetites, it is you who has to be healed or treated or reformed or corrected or improved. If you are sick, it is you who need medication. If you are poor, it is undoubtedly something for which inwardly you are responsible, or else you are a victim. In other words, the word you is the devil. You are the devil, you see, because if you're sinful, it's your fault. If you're poor, it's usually your fault. Even when you had nothing to do with being poor, you at least were the victim. So it was you again. If you were sick, it's you. You got in the draft, or you contracted the disease, or you got in the way of the germ, or you were living in the wrong climate, or you ate the wrong food. You are the devil. You're the very devil who is tripping up your whole life's experience. All the time that you are seeking good, you're the very devil causing evil, according to the world. And therein lies the ignorance of all religious teachings, so that even when they declare God is all, God is everywhere, equally present, God is perfect, God is love, God governs you, God guides you, God directs you, even when they declare that, they cannot demonstrate it. You still are in as much trouble as if God weren't all those nice things, and as if God were a billion miles away from you. And the reason is this. First place, all religious teachings ascribes goodness to you, and you have no goodness. You are not good, you are not spiritual, you are not perfect, you are not harmonious. If you were, you wouldn't be sitting here. You'd be out bearing witness to it. You'd be out living it, instead of trying to learn it or trying to demonstrate it. Now, when, instead of bearing witness to your goodness and your perfection and your spirituality, as is done in metaphysical teachings, if you will bear witness to God in action, you will immediately bring about a change of some kind, and for good, in your experience. The very moment that you declare, do not call me good, do not call me spiritual, do not call me anything, let us understand that God is the only good, God is the only activity of good, God is the only law of good, God is the only cause, and God is the only effect, and there is no me, there is only God. God itself within itself, expressing itself unto itself. God, God, God. God is the all in all. When you bear witness to God as the life of individual being, as the mind of individual being, the soul and the spirit and the body of individual being, the law, cause, and effect of individual being, you have begun your spiritual development. As long as you are using words like he, she, and it, I, me, and mine, you are trying to spiritualize form or spiritualize the illusion of life. And it cannot be done. The moment you say, oh, this dog is a spiritual idea or this cat is a perfect idea, you are as far off the beam as the religion that says that we are all scum of the earth and not fit to approach the hem of the robe. Both of these are wrong. God alone is good, and beside God there is none other. There is no me, he, she, or it. That which appears to us as he, she, it is God. If only you can see with the spiritual vision, you will see that it's God in action. You will see that it's God in manifestation, that it is God itself. Then, when you see God instead of an it, he, or she, then the it, he, or she begins to take on more nearly the appearance of a God being. Now watch this. Instead of declaring any virtues for yourself or for others, declare those virtues as of God. God alone is the light of the day. God alone is the brightness of the night. God alone is the law of growth, of progress, of unfoldment. God alone is the source of all being. God alone is the activity of all being. God alone is the soul and the purity and the perfection of all being. This is bearing witness to God in action. God omnipresence, God omnipotence, God omniscience. God all in all. You never perfect yourself in this as long as you are dealing with he's, she's, it's. You do perfect yourself in proportion as you bear witness to God in action and realize God. God alone is being. Then God is eternal being. God is immortal being. God is perfect being. God is harmonious being. God is the essence. Now, this one step will begin to bring changes in your experience, but it will not bring the final and complete harmony or even the demonstration of spiritual power in your life. That of itself will not do it. There again, we have teachings on earth, not in the organized way, that do recognize this very fact, the one ego, the one life, the one mind. And yet, they do very little in the way of bringing forth real harmony into the experience of their followers. And the reason for it lies in the inability to accept what we know about the nature of error. Supposing I tell you that it becomes necessary not merely to bear witness to God in action, but that it becomes necessary to bear witness to the nature of error in order to bring the final demonstration of harmony into experience. In other words, if I were to be in my meditations and realizing only the allness of God without any knowledge of the nature of error, because my knowledge of the letter of truth would only be half correct, I wouldn't even achieve half the demonstrations to which I was entitled. The reason is this. Just as you are not good, so you are not evil. Just as you are not good, neither are you a sinner. Neither are you the one who is poor, neither are you the one who contracts a disease or contacts one. It has nothing to do with you. And that is why no amount of right thinking that you do will ever, ever solve your problems. Because your wrong thinking didn't cause them. And your right thinking won't cure them. There is only one thing that will bring an end to the discords and inharmonies of individual experience. And that is an understanding of the truth. The first half of that understanding deals with the fact, do not call me good. There is but one good. There is but one life, one mind, one soul, one law, one cause, one being, and one effect. Now, also do not call me evil. I don't care that you saw me stick my hand in someone's pocket and run away with their wallet. Do not call me evil. Don't do it. I had no more to do with it than I had to do with its opposite when I was good to somebody. When I was good to somebody, it was the activity of God through me. When I was evil, it was the activity of that one thing that we call in Christian science, it's called mortal mind. Otherwise, we would call it the human sense of life, or physical sense of life, or material sense of life, or structural sense of life, a sense of separation from God being. It is a universal thing, this thing called error. And if you saw a thief out here and wanted to help him, take your thought immediately off of him and realize that the universal belief of a selfhood apart from God is not a power, or that the universal belief in lack and limitation is not a power, or the universal belief in getting good is not a power. In other words, whatever the form of error may be, it isn't his error, it is a universal belief. In other words, you have read this many, many times, and more especially during the Depression, of people who were brought into court stealing as little as a loaf of bread for their families. And of course, in most cases where the judges hadn't become entirely judgified, they let the so-called thief go. Now, with the amount of that that we read, you might just as well admit that potentially we are all thieves. Because if a depression came and we had families and no bread for them, and we saw bread lying around on somebody's doorstep or milk, it's hard to say that, well, I think I'd let my family starve and not take it. Well, here and there you might find one, but not many. Self-preservation is the first law of nature, but the self-preservation of my child or my parent or my wife or my husband, that's a strong instinct in an individual. And so then, from that standpoint, humanly, the error isn't yours or mine or his or hers who succumbs to it, but the universal sense of lack, the universal sense of separation from God, which is operating at any given moment to bring lack to us. Now, in realization of that, when an individual comes to us for help, first thing that you must do is bear witness to God in action. Bear witness within yourself to the realization that invisible, right here, is the Christ, the activity of Christ, and the law of Christ. The Spirit of God is in action, even though appearances testify otherwise. And now what of this appearance? This is the one illusion, the one universal belief of separation from good. This is the one universal belief of a law apart from God. Now, the very moment that you stop personalizing good, you start the flow of blessings. But the moment that you stop personalizing evil, you complete the picture. The very moment you can look at Satan in the form of Judas Iscariot and say, this man, Judas, isn't a sinner. Father, forgive him, he knows not what he does. Satan, the one evil, the one sense of selfhood apart from God, and it isn't a presence or a power, it has no one in whom or through whom to operate, then you begin to nullify it. In other words, when you see a dead electric bulb, don't immediately believe that all electricity is dead, but know that the electricity is there in its lifeness, and change your bulb and you've got your electricity in action again. And so it is when you see an individual showing signs of deadness, whether of sin or disease, don't be concerned with them. That's an appearance. And if you will begin to realize that that appearance doesn't concern that individual, it concerns a universal sense of an individual, in that moment, do you have a new bulb there? The dead has become alive. the entombed has been resurrected. Now, you bear witness, regardless of appearances, to God in action, the very moment you know that God is the life of this individual, the mind, the soul, the spirit. God is the only law operating here. God is the only being. God is the only cause. God is the only effect. This is a spiritual universe, the product of a spiritual creative law and being. Thus you are bearing witness to God in action. And then you say, ah, yes, but what of this sin that I'm beholding, of this evil? Yes, yes, I won't deny it. I will deny it as a part of this individual. I will accept only that it is a universal belief of a selfhood apart from God and has nothing to do with this individual. There is such a belief if there were no individuals on earth. In other words, if there weren't an individual on all the earth, the belief that 2 times 2 is 5 would still be in consciousness. And the minute some first man would be born, it would be possible for him to accept it. Thus we have in the fabulous story of Adam and Eve. Here is a perfect world, a perfect universe to all outward appearances, but here also is the potential belief of a selfhood and a creation apart from God, and the first man who comes into the world takes on that belief. The belief must have been there for him to have accepted. Otherwise, he himself would have been the inventor of that belief, and then we wouldn't be suffering from it. It would be his instead of ours. But you see, they removed him from the world, but they didn't remove the belief. The next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And so it is. You can watch. Because I have never been a parent, I have been able to observe it objectively. All children are exactly alike, and they all do the same thing at the same ages. They do the same cute things, and they do the same bad things. A 2-year-old child is 2 years, and you can't make it anything else. It's going to be good, and it's going to be bad. It's going to be troublesome, and it's going to be angelic, because why? It isn't that child at all. It's just being 2 years of age. That's all. When it's 13 years of age, it's also going to be 13 years of age. And you watch one child of 13, and you'll watch them all at 13. Parents don't always like to hear that, but you watch it objectively, and you'll soon find it's true. The same mischief one gets in, the other gets in. Now, there are a few exceptions, because all tastes aren't alike. So one will get in trouble in one way, and another in another way. One will be mischievous in one way, and another in another. One will be good in one way, and another in another. But on the whole, you look out at this world at 10-year-old children, at 13-year-old children, at 16-year-old children, and you'll say they all came out of the same mold. Now, that is as close to being universally true as it can be. Why? Because the children have nothing to do with it. It has to do with the fact that they are responding to the human belief about them as of that age. Where that belief came from, I don't know. Why 14, 15, 16-year-old children have to be sassy or have to disobey or have to believe that their parents don't know it all, believe that they don't know anything, I don't know. It's a pretty universal belief. It's so universal that we have sayings about it. You know those, like at 20, I knew that I knew everything that was to be known in the world. At 30, I began to suspect that perhaps I didn't know it all. And at 40, I knew that it was my parents who knew it all. That's a universal claim. That's a universal belief. Everyone goes through these beliefs. If you were to see people with certain diseases and see how they respond in the same way to the same disease, when you see people at the age of puberty, when you see them at the age of menstruation, when you see them at the age of menopause, you'd think that every one of them were writing the same letter that you've been getting for 20 years. And it is so. They all respond to the same thing in the same way. Why? Because it's a response to a universal urge. It isn't necessary. It can be nullified. It can be nullified any of these things can be nullified, especially in the experience of those who would like them nullified. And by the handling of error as a universal claim instead of your error or mine, instead of pinning some form of error and saying, this person is obstinate, this person is dictatorial, this person is dishonest, this person is immoral, this person is so-and-so. Instead of that, by ignoring the appearance of this and that person, not ignoring the claim, never ignore the claim, ignore the person, and handle the claim through realizing that this claim is not personal. It has nothing to do with the person claiming it. It has to do with a universal sense of a selfhood apart from God, a universal sense of a law apart from God. Remember, if you were dealing with law of infection, a law of contagion, you would have to not blame your patient for it. You would have to get back and say, well, no, if God is law and God is infinite, there can be no law of disease, no law of infection, no law of contagion. This is only a universal belief. Why blame a tiny child for having an infectious or contagious disease? What had they to do with it? They were just the innocent victims of a universal belief. Well, so are the adults. Regardless of the name or nature of their crime, or of their sickness, or the depth of it, or the degree of it, it's true with old age. You would be surprised the wonderful work I have seen among people under the claim of old age. The moment it was brought into realization that age has nothing to do with a person, no person can be older than another person, because God is infinite person, the only person appearing as individual beings. So we're all the same age as God. Age can't change us. Age can't make us. But the universal belief of a life apart from God, the universal belief of a selfhood apart from God, the universal belief of a law of matter, the universal belief of a law of deterioration of matter, the law of diminishing returns, all of these things operate in our consciousness and appear on our bodies and our pocketbooks. Now, bear witness to God in action. Regardless of what condition you see on earth, regardless of what condition you see in a person, bear witness first of all to the truth that God is this individual being. God constitutes all there is to this being. God is the creative principle. God is the maintaining and the sustaining influence. Bear witness to God in action. And as you drive on the road, as you walk through the city streets, watch. Bear witness to the fact that here indeed is very Christ. Then, as common sense says to you, oh, but this doesn't look like it, not what I'm looking at, not who I'm seeing before me, not the horrors that I'm witnessing, then take your second step and bear witness to the fact, no, here I am seeing the effects of a universal sense of a selfhood apart from God. I'm seeing the effects of a universal belief in a law or activity or cause apart from God. And such beliefs, being only beliefs, are not power. They do not have the activity of God behind them. They do not have the law to support them, uphold them, or sustain them. I see them for what they are, a belief of a selfhood apart from God, a belief of medical law, theological law. Why don't you know that 3/4 of the world is suffering from theology? Because theology has given the world this horrible belief of God punishing us for our sins. And you'd be surprised how minor those sins can be to bring on major punishments. And we have accepted those both consciously and unconsciously until even in the experience of my work, I find three-quarters of the people writing me a letter and saying, well, of course, I suppose it's really my fault. Oh, well, I suppose I've done something. Or I'm being punished for something that I have done. And there's nothing finer to keep you in bondage to sickness for the rest of your life than to believe you are being punished for something that happened yesterday or 1,000 years ago. No, it is true that we punish ourselves for the wrongs that we do. But there is no God of punishment, and so there is no punishment when we stop doing the wrong. And that ends the whole business of karma, and as ye sow, so shall ye reap. You see, the law of as ye sow, so shall ye reap operates in this wise. If you are a human being, and you have accepted the fact that there are laws of inheritance, laws of matter, infection, contagion, birth, heredity, death. If you have accepted that, and every human being in the world has just by virtue of being born, then that law is in operation because you have sown the seed of materiality. In other words, you've sown to the flesh. You've sown to the belief that flesh has power, matter has power, material law has power, and so you must reap corruption. Just by virtue of being born, you are eternally sowing to the flesh. Every belief that you are accepting about matter, materiality, physicality, is a sowing to the flesh. Now, there's nothing you can reap out of that but materiality, which ends in death. If at one given moment of your life you make a transition to where you sow to the spirit, then you reap life everlasting. Now, the only one way you can ever reap to the spirit is to acknowledge spirit as the source, creative principle, law, cause, and effect of all that is. The very moment that you learn to love the infinite invisible through the realization that it is from the invisible that all visible effect appears, and that nothing in the realm of effect can affect something else in the realm of effect, in that moment you are sowing to the spirit. You may not reap the full fruitage with the first sowing, for the simple reason that when you first make the declaration, you don't really believe it. You have no inner conviction of it. You only have an intellectual grasp of it and an intellectual acceptance of it. It is just like agreeing that God is all in all. Of course, you all agree to that, but there isn't one of us that has the complete realization of it. And that is why not one of us has the complete demonstration of it. In some measure, each one of us has intellectually agreed that God is all, that God is life, God is mind, God is soul, God is spirit, God is law, God is substance, God is activity, God is essence, God is true being. In some measure, every one of us has intellectually accepted that. In some lesser measure, each one of us has achieved the conviction of it and is thereby demonstrating some measure of it. Now, as we continue to abide, to bear witness to the fact that spirit, the invisible, is the cause of the visible, that the invisible is the law unto the visible, that the infinite invisible is the essence and activity, and that we look to our good and to the good of this universe only to the invisible, not to anyone or to anything in the visible, except that anyone or everyone in the visible may be an instrument through which the invisible operates. But actually, we understand intellectually, we understand that there is an invisible presence and power in this room, as there is in all the universe, that when we permit it, operates through us. That invisible can so purify us that we never again would injure each other, would never be unjust or unkind or untrue to each other, that we would never be negative in any way, shape, manner, or form to each other. The very moment we could agree on that invisible as the source of our being, we lose the power to give effect to anything that would cause negative conduct to each other. We still would retain the ability to watch our step with others outside this room. We still would have some measure of distrust, of fear, of criticism, of condemnation, because we'd say, ah, yes, we here in this room may all sin at some time or other, but at least we know one thing about each other. None of us is doing it intentionally or corruptly or because we want to do it. It's just some temporary thing that has gotten the best of our understanding, and so we'd be very kind and very forgiving of each other and to each other, I hope at least. But we are not quite so ready to believe that the man outside or woman is acting from a universal impulse, and so we kind of think, well, no, I think he's a thief, or she is this, or so forth. And so we would not, even at this point, be quite ready to put our arms around the Russian government in a full sense of trust. And you see the reason for it, because we have not come to the conviction that even the Russian government is only an instrument for God, and that its errors are not their errors, but a universal belief. Ah, see how it comes back to that same thing over and over and over again. The moment we could begin to realize, even a group as small as we are, that the errors of the Russian government are not really the errors of those men, or even of the men who founded it, but actually, this universal claim of a selfhood and activity apart from God, universal sense of separation, then you would begin to see in some measure how these evils would diminish, because that's the work that is being done in the world today. And as far as I'm concerned, that is the world that is bringing, that is the work that is bringing about changes in consciousness. You see, in my prison work, I saw the miracle of working with men whom the world calls sinners. And just by ignoring them and holding fast to this truth of the One, of the Universal One, I have seen miracles take place such as even if I told them to you, you wouldn't believe them. I have told classes that it was my prison experience that opened my eyes to the realization of this point. I learned it in my prison experience. And it came about in this wise, that when I was appointed Christian Science reader, first reader, in a prison in New York, I was told by a committee worker to protect myself from sin-filled thought when I went into the prison. And you may not know it, but I'm a very obedient sort of person and very loyal. And I do, as a rule, what I'm told until I find out it isn't right. Then you can't move me. I'm like that animal out there. Now, on Friday night, every Friday night, I began to protect myself from sin-filled thought, and I kept on protecting myself until Sunday morning. And so the first Sunday morning that I stood in the platform, Mrs. Eddy and Jesus Christ hit me so hard that I nearly fell off the platform. The Bible wanted to jump off the table and hit me in the face. Science and health, I had to hold down by putting my hand on it that way. I knew if I ever let go of it, it would come right up and smack me. And I didn't know why. When I finished reading, I thought, well, this is about as much of a mess as anyone could get into. I don't want to come back here anymore. Not with this sin-filled thought. I went to see my teacher. And my teacher said he would help me, but the next Sunday was just the same. I went to see him again, and the next Sunday was just the same. And finally he said, well, maybe I can't help you. You might have to work it out alone. So I said, all right. And Friday night, I began doing my protective work. And in the midst of it, the thought came to me, wait, what is this? What is this? I had just shortly before that read a statement, man has no mind but God. That's in Science and Health. Man has no mind but God. Well, if man has no mind but God, where'd he get a sin-filled thought? That's what's wrong. The minister goes in the platform, the priest goes in, the rabbi goes in, all because they're a sin-filled thought that they are going to reform, and none of them ever do the reforming. The men come back and back and back and back again. Even here in Hawaii, last week in the paper, the warden said, the sad part is that 60% of all the men come back a second, third, and fourth time. Why? There are 13 ministers go out to Oahu prison. And all 13 don't seem able to reform those boys. And here I was, I don't know what I was doing in that prison in New York, but I was evidently doing the same as the rabbi, the priest, and the minister. I was going there because there was sin-filled thought, and little me was going to do something about it. In that realization, I saw the whole picture. There is no sin-filled thought except the human belief. Well, that's why they're in prison, because of the belief of sin, because of the belief of sin-filled thought. I wasn't in prison. Evidently, I didn't believe in sin. They were in prison. They believed in sin. Evidently, the judge believed in it too, and the jury and the attorneys. Ah, yes, there's the trouble, the belief in sin, the belief in sinners. But man has no mind but God. There can be no such thing. It can't operate. Well, you know what happened? When I became first reader there, the average attendance before my time had been 8 to 11 men on Sunday for that service. And during the first 4 weeks of my reading, we still averaged 8 to 11 men. But right after that realization, we increased. And if I'm not mistaken, it was 6 weeks after the 4 weeks, 77 men came to that service. And do you know something? That at the end of 2 years, 200 men were attending the service, and we had 15 men doing healing work in the prison. Yes, there was a record there that is very difficult to ask anyone to believe. And it all came about through one awakening. The awakening to the realization that we don't go to prison to heal sinners. Sin is a belief of a selfhood apart from God. It's a belief that man has a mind apart from God, and a body apart from God, and a will apart from God. But you see that one with God as a majority, and that one Christ idea can carry a million men across the sea of illusion? Certainly. One individual in the realization of beholding, witnessing God in action, number one. And then witnessing error as a universal illusion changes the whole work. I try to tell this. This is in some of the recordings because I've told it to class after class. Because unless our students recognize this, they will not do the greater works. People out in the metaphysical world wonder that an inexperienced speaker and a person with no religious background can go into city after city after city and draw the crowds that come to hear the message of the Infinite Way, witness the large classes that form around the message of the Infinite Way, and they wonder how it's done when all over the land others are not able to do it. And I say very honestly and very frankly, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with books. It has to do with bearing witness to God in action and bearing witness to evil as a universal illusion. Because just as in that prison, that realization took the burden of guilt off of men who never heard me say this. They just felt no condemnation in my consciousness, and they were drawn to that light. And so it is in this work, wherever I go, I am sure that people feel the lack of condemnation in my consciousness, that I hold nobody in any form of error. Not that I'm trying to be holier than thou. I'm trying to bring to light that not one of us is responsible for the sicknesses or sins that we commit. We are only responsible in the degree that we have not achieved the realization of God as our individual being and of all error as a universal illusion. No presence, no power, no law, no cause, and no effect. Do you see that? That lifts the burden of guilt from everybody. And so, those individuals who really are walking around with a sense of human guilt for something in their lives feel their freedom when they come in contact with this message, and they feel that sense of go and sin no more, even though it's never said to them. So it is with the burden of accepting these universal beliefs of disease, of lack. No use of preaching. There's no room in this work for preaching to anyone or at anyone. Preaching isn't going to do any good. There's no such thing as a holier-than-thou person in all of this work. This is a work of a revelation of universal truth. Accept it or reject it. That's your individual demonstration. But on my part, there must be, in my seat, this realization that I am beholding God in action, and that I am beholding the activity of a universal illusion trying to appear as sin, disease, death, lack, and limitation. And with those two points, my work is done, whether in class, whether in the healing work, or any other part of my ministry. When I go into these corporation and union activities, you know right well that if I had a sense of condemnation, even for the worst of the labor leaders, that I would come out just the same as anybody else would come out. Nowhere. And on the other hand, if I believe for a minute that capital was some kind of an angel walking around without visible wings, I would also be on the wrong side of the fence. Now, regardless of who is humanly right or humanly wrong, that is not your function or mine when we are engaged in this work. As a matter of fact, living the Infinite Way, we are not entitled to judge, criticize, or condemn. We are entitled to this. If I present this truth to you, you having come for it, and then over and over and over and over, you bear witness to the fact that you are ignoring this truth, and that you are going to live your life your way and have your will be done, undoubtedly the time will come when I will say, look, please don't take up my time. There are enough people in the world ready to give up themselves for the self, so that I'm not going around being your personal confessor or personal healer for the rest of your days. You either come into line, or please, let me free to work with others. I will do that, and I have done it, and I'm still doing it over and over again. Not with judgment, not with criticism. There are just these individuals who, for the moment, can see no higher than their own will, their own desires, their own ego, and because of that, the master could say, I come to those, only those of my own household. And that's why the woman at the well of Samaria was surprised that he would even take time talking to her, because it was known that he understood that his mission was among the Hebrews, because the Hebrews of that day were seemingly the only ones really seeking the light of a one God. And so he knew that it would be useless to preach this to people who did not have their inner ears open or their inner eyes open. Well, so it is today, only we draw no lines of whether they are Jew or Gentile, Greek, bond or free, black or white, when we make our sense of separation. But we do have a sense of separation, and that is this: I come also to those of my own household. I do not go out into the world to carry this message. I go only into those places where I am invited. I do not go out on street corners nor hire big auditoriums. Why? I will sit right here in this room and let the Father lead those to me. Or I will travel to those cities where it is evident that there are those assembled and waiting and who have given indication that they are waiting for this word. Then I will go and be as free in speaking as I am here. That does not change the fact that I am not holding the rest of the world in condemnation, but I am recognizing the self-evident fact that you cannot ask those who have founded their lives on the one word, me, I, mine, myself. You cannot ask them to give up that until they are ready for the experience. You may not realize it, perhaps you haven't thought of it, that any one nation on the face of the globe could end war forever and forever and forever in any one hour that they willed. It would be a possibility in any hour of the day or night to see peace established on earth with never again a discharged bullet. How? Only one nation would have to publish to the world, you can kill us if you like, but we are not going to kill you. We've decided thou shalt not kill. We have decided it would be much better for us to die to find life eternal than to live at the expense of taking your life. In other words, we're going to follow the teaching of the master. And so, how could war take place after that? There could be no war. There never lived a nation that could take up arms against somebody that had no arms. There never could be anyone take up weapons against the person who leaves themselves defenseless in God, who takes God as their sure defense. There's no question about this. This is a matter of revelation, of unfoldment. Those who live by the sword must die by the sword. Now, I could call this to your attention, that every parent that permits a child to go into uniform is virtually saying, here is my nice 18, 20-year-old child, take him and kill him so that we can live. Let him take the chance of dying so that we older generation can stay home and live. That's all it amounts to. It would be just as easy a matter to say to the government, no, take us for your army and leave these children home. They had nothing to do with this condition. And it's far better that we who are already in middle years die in war than the youth who haven't had a beginning do it. You would quickly see that war could be ended. Ah, but how are you going to end war while we ourselves say, here are the 20-year-olds, let them die for us. And we all consent to it. There's no movement yet anywhere in the land by any parents to keep their sons from being killed to save them. Think of that. Nowhere is there a movement yet. That movement alone would be the beginning of the end of war, because it would hold up to parents the horror of what they're doing. We're all guilty of it. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I've had stepchildren in war, and if I had children of my own, they'd have been in war. I was in war, my parents knew I was in war. So I'm not criticizing. I'm stating that which is a fact, that we are letting 20-year-olds die so that 50-year-olds may stay home and live. And it isn't intelligent even from a human standpoint. But from a spiritual standpoint, there should be a movement in which it should be known, and I don't mean a human organization, a movement of consciousness in which it should be known that we accept the truth. I'd rather die than save my life at your expense. Then see the power of the Christ teaching on earth, because that is the Christ teaching. You cannot find your life until you lose it. Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. Sacrifice self, because can you die? No, and you know it. But there are those who really believe that they can die. And for them, going out to battle, for them being killed is a horror. But for the spiritually illumined, there's no horror about passing out of this human sense of existence. Everyone else has done it before. We will do it in our time. A few years younger, a few years older. No horror about that. Now let us see this vision. We behold God in action, but we behold any and every form of error as universal belief. Now that is being done on earth in this very day. There are those who are holding no one in judgment, criticism, or condemnation for errors which are not personal to them, but which are universal beliefs. But those who understand that universal belief is not a power and cannot forever perpetuate itself will bring an end to it, and that is taking place on earth today. There are those all over the earth who are consciously realizing that the men who are the instruments for evil are not the evil. That if you remove them, others will spring up to take their places. I can go back in memory to the days of the Tsar and the horrors of life in Russia for those who had to live under Tsarism. I guess it was a wonderful thing for the few families who constituted the Upper New Deal. It was a horrible thing for those who contributed to it. And it was thought that when you removed the Tsar, that you were going to remove the evils, and so a worse evil grew upon them. And there's any question that this that is there now is a worse evil in and of itself. But just as the Tsar had to make way for this other as a step away from centralized control, so will this be removed in its time. Because the very nothingness of the universal evil is an assurance that in time it will all be wiped out. And this too will pass. But there will be no use of it passing by revolution. It must pass by evolution. It is the same with the evils in our country. Certainly, you know that I lived in New York City when a financier said, "The public be damned." And you certainly know that nobody has even accused Wall Street of having wings. Certainly we know the evils of Wall Street. Certainly we know the evils of some of the old forms of capitalism. Certainly it is in my memory that a steel corporation called out the militia and had men shot down for asking $2.50 a day wages. A day, not an hour. We know all that. But does revolution change that? No, evolution changes that. Evolution changes that, not revolution. Certainly there were times when Negroes were sold on a platform. Certainly they were beaten. Certainly they were ill-treated. You don't think for a minute that the Civil War changed that. Evolution changes that. Not revolution, evolution. How does the evolution take place? Through enlightenment. Through enlightenment. But whereas the enlightenment of education, as a rule, comes first, ultimately it must lead to spiritual enlightenment. It must come to a state of enlightenment in which every individual can say, "I would rather lose my life than take yours. At least in losing my human sense of life, I am acknowledging the immortality of my own being. Whereas if I were to take your life, I would be declaring that I have only a limited life and I'm going to hold on to it." So you see, the Master's message is the clearest ever given to the world, that you must not call me good, not even a me who wears the white robe of Jesus Christ. There is but one good, the Father in heaven. But that same ministry declares to Pilate, "Thou couldest have no power over me unless it came from the Father in heaven." In other words, even you, with your high legal power, political power, even you have no power except God's power.